nanohub.org.
You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Print them out and turn each page when you hear the following sound. Enjoy the show.
Good morning. My name is Mark Thorson. I'm one of Vlad Shalayev's graduate students, and he's at a conference this morning. Actually, he's at a conference all week, so we're going to be doing a lecture without him. Today's lecture is Lecture 10, Surface Plasma on Excitation. And we're going to be going through these. This is mostly a lecture on the mechanics of how you excite surface plasmons, how you get them to appear and show up and do what they do at all. And we're going to be going through it relatively quickly. If you have any questions, I can try to answer them. If you have any involved questions, I suggest that you talk to Dr. Shalayev when he gets back. Which brings me to another point. You don't have class at all next week, neither Tuesday nor Thursday, so in the meantime, you should read everything you can in the research. Okay, let's get started. Here's a summary of today's lecture. We're going to be looking at the dispersion relationship for surface plasmons. It's my understanding that you've gone through this a little bit in the previous lecture. And if you don't remember, because it's been weeks and weeks ago, then I will go through it again briefly. And then we're going to be talking about coupling light to surface plasmon polaritons. And there are several ways to do this, the most important of which is this Kretschmann geometry, which is the second one down on the list here. We'll go through that in some detail. It's one of the more useful techniques to couple light to these plasmon excitation modes. You can also use grating couplings and couplings using sub-wavelength features, and then there's just about anything you can imagine. If it will work, then you can use it. The key is that you have to have something that will work in the first place. So the dispersion relationship for surface plasmon polaritons. From the previous page, we have that the K vector for the surface plasmon polaritons is given by omega over C times some square root term with permittivities of the metal and the dielectric. Epsilon sub m is the metal, epsilon sub d is the dielectric. On the right, we have a plot of those permittivities. You'll see that the dielectric is wavelength independent, or if you prefer, frequency independent. That just means that your dielectric material has predominantly the same dielectric function throughout all of the frequency range. However, the metal strongly depends on frequency, and as you can see from the K relationship, from the dispersion relationship, we have a resonance when epsilon sub m equals minus epsilon sub d. And that is noted here. The K sub x relationship shows that the K goes to infinity, or would go to infinity in this case, when epsilon sub m equals minus epsilon sub d. And the denominator here in your square root term just shows that very nicely. So at that frequency, we're going to define surface plasmon frequency. So omega at that is at that point is omega sub sp. If we look at this, wave vector relationship, this dispersion relationship, for the limit of low omega, we have a slightly interesting case. If we look at it in low omega, we get omega over C times the limit as epsilon sub m goes to infinity, minus infinity rather, of our square root term, which is approximately equal to omega over C times the square root of epsilon d. Now, those of you that have done some optics in the past, and those of you that have looked at this at all, will notice that this looks very similar to your standard constant phase velocity, constant group velocity, monochromatic wave relationship, dispersion relationship, which would be just K equals omega over C. We have epsilon sub D in there, which is also equal to the refractive index of the dielectric. So this is just the standard dispersion relationship inside of a dielectric medium. So we call that the light line, and it's shown on the graph here as this linear line That would be the dispersion relationship if you had light at this frequency in glass. The solution for the surface plasma and polariton excitation, those modes that are guided modes along metal interfaces, those all lie below the light line. That's the curved line, the parabolic line in the graph on the right on the bottom. And those solutions all lie below the light line, so that's a problem. We can't match those without doing some tricks. So this is what we're going to be talking about today. What tricks can we play? What tricks can we use to match our K-vector, if you will, in the light realm to our K-vector in the surface plasmon realm? Let's look some more at the dispersion relationship for bulk and surface plasmons. On this graph, we have on the vertical axis omega, and we have omega sub p, which is our plasma frequency. Off the top of my head, I don't know which metal this is, but this is some metal, and we have some plasma frequency, which you discussed in previous lectures. We also have our light line, which is omega equals c times kx, just a reworking of the math for our previous light line expression. And then we have omega sub sp comma air, which is the air metal interface and the surface plasmon omega for that interface. So if you wanted a surface plasmon at the air metal interface, which is going to be different than the surface plasmon frequency for the metal dielectric interface or some dielectric other than air, then you would have this frequency. And if you have some other dielectric, you'd have a different frequency. Notice that the frequency, if the dielectric has a dielectric constant greater than air, or if you prefer greater than one, then the refractive index of the dielectric is going to be greater than that of air, and your frequency goes down, which means you can also think of it as a red shift of the wavelength. And that's what's noted here at the bottom. A higher index medium, a dielectric that has a higher index, results in a lower surface plasmon frequency. And at the bottom, of the very bottom of the page, we note that omega equals omega sp. Again, when epsilon sub m equals 1 over plasma frequency squared over omega squared, that comes from the Drude formula, which you should have discussed previously. And when that frequency, expression equals minus epsilon sub d, then you get a very nice form for your omega frequency, which is given on the bottom over there. So our goal is to excite these surface plasmon polaritons with light. The reason that we want to do it with light is that we'd really like to be able to couple light, which has relatively long wavelength in terms of the structures that we're talking about, long being a few hundred nanometers. We want to couple that to structures that have 10, 20, 50 nanometer scale sizes. And in general, you can't do that unless you're playing some tricks. So this is our issue. The problem is that the SPP, which is surface plasmon polariton, SPP modes lie below the light line, which means that there's no coupling between the far field and the SPP modes. And if you think about that, what that means is that if you were to take a laser, which is a far field system, if you were to take a laser and shine it onto a system that will typically excite or typically support SPPs, you can't get them to couple. You have to play some tricks. So the laser and the SPP modes, the far field radiation and the SPP modes, don't couple to each other. So we have to play some tricks to get those things to work. So trick number one is we excite the SPP from a higher index medium into a lower index medium. And we can see that from the dispersion relationships that we've got shown in the graph. Again, we have our linear light line, omega over k equals c, that's constant with respect to frequency. We have our excitation frequency omega sub e. And we can see that at the excitation frequency, we're crossing several dispersion lines. One of them is Dr. Schleif has drawn down several verticals to point out where those lie on the K line, on the wave vector line. And you can see that the dispersion relationship for surface plasmons is the curved line. The dispersion relationship for the light line in the higher index medium is the linear line, the bluish linear line. And you can see that there's some overlap between the bluish linear line and the curved line, which means that we can couple those more effectively. Specifically, K sub H, which is the high index medium wave vector, is larger than K sub SP. And in that case, then we can excite the surface plasmon polariton at the high index interface to the metal using a higher index medium. The question is, how do you actually get this to work in practice? Because you can't excite it from a high index medium directly into the metal, because then you have the same situation as you had just in air to the metal. Well, some folks back in the day have figured this out, and one of them was named Kretschmann. And the geometry that he has used, there's also a geometry called Otto, which is a slightly different version of this. The Kretschmann is by far the one that's most widely used, because it's the one that allows you to get any data out of the system. The Otto geometry works, but it sort of buries the surface plasmon inside of the system, and so it's not very useful. So the Kretschmann geometry looks like this. It's a prism, and the prism is made of typically silicon dioxide, quartz, something like that. On the prism, on one face, you have placed a thin metal film. The metal film is thin enough such that you can actually get evanescent modes through the thickness of the film. So if you have an evanescent mode on one side, you can see it on the other side as well. And that's what we're going to use. We're going to shine light through one face of the prism towards the metal dielectric interface. And if we use total internal reflection of the prism, which you all remember from your optics or electromagnetics courses, if you use the trick of total internal reflection, then at the prism metal interface, you're going to get evanescent modes. Those evanescent modes will actually show up on the far side of the metal, and those modes can excite surface plasmon polaritons, but only on the metal-air interface, so the upper interface of the metal in this drawing. So we have a K surface plasmon from the dispersion relationship shown on the top of the metal-air interface. You don't get surface plasmon modes at the dielectric metal interface. Yes, Justin?
So it seems from this picture that the total internal reflection is taking place inside from the prism to the metal.
Right.
So you're saying the prism has a higher index than the metal?
Right. I'm saying that the prism experiences total internal reflection. And that'll happen for some range of angles in this prism configuration. So at the point when you get total internal reflection, or at an angle where you get total internal reflection, you would expect to see the vast majority of the light reflected back out of the prism on the other side. And really what you're doing by placing the metal there is you're allowing the prism the opportunity to break the rules for total internal reflection. At some point, the evanescent modes, which cause the reflection, the evanescent modes that you create, will actually propagate to the other side. Propagate's not the right word, but I'm going to use it. Propagate to the other side of the metal interface, which causes a decrease in the reflection that you're going to see coming out of the prism. So you would expect to see, we're going to show some graphs here that'll make it pretty clear, but you would expect to see, as you move the angle, as you change the angle of incidence, it's theta in this diagram, as you change the angle of incidence, if you're in the range of total internal reflection, you expect to see complete reflection all through those angles. If you have this sort of a situation, though, at some point you're going to excite the surface plasma and polaritons on the far side of the metal. That takes some amount of energy. The energy comes out of your incident laser beam, and you're actually going to see a dip, a large dip, in reflection. And so we're sort of breaking the rules of total internal reflection at the point at which the K vectors for our incident light and our surface plasmon match. Then you get coupling to the surface plasmon mode, and the reflection goes down significantly. Okay, you'll see that here in a second.
I guess my question is, I don't see how the light or the glass has a higher index than the metal.
You mean you're confused about how total internal reflection would occur in any case?
Yeah.
Let's talk about it after. I don't want to get too far off base. We can talk about it after, okay? So at a certain point, we're going to see a strong coupling between the surface plasmon K vector, which is on the top in red, and the parallel K vector of the SiO2 metal interface, which is on the bottom in what appears to be sort of a bluish color.
But it doesn't define me.
Sure.
It doesn't have to be total internal reflection in the sense optical fibers work. This can be just reflection of a metal plane. Of course, we know there would be some skin depth for the propagation inside the metal that should penetrate through the thin film. You see, in that case, it's not total internal reflection, it's just reflection through a conductor where you get most of the wave reflected, but some which is propagating into the skin depth of the metal. Can that
There's going to be some drawings here, some graphs here in a few minutes that if they don't answer your question, we'll come back to it. Okay, see you? Okay. What I want to point out, there's an important point at the bottom of this graph, of this page. What we're actually doing here is we're matching both energy and momentum, and when those two match, then we get strong coupling between our incident field, our incident evanescent mode at the interface of the metal and dielectric, and the surface plasmon mode at the interface of the air and metal. So we're matching both of those considerations, and when those match properly, we get strong coupling. Here's just some more details about what's going on. We've got another dispersion relationship graph. These things are getting a little bit complicated down here because now we have the light line for air. We also have the light line for glass. We have the surface plasmon at the metal-air interface, which is the red curve line. We also have the surface plasmon dispersion relationship at the metal-glass interface, which is the other curved line. And if we work through the math, I'm not going to go through this in great detail. If you have any questions, we can talk about it after, or you can ask Dr. Shalaev when he comes back. But if you go through the math, you can find the K vector at which you match your surface plasmon K vector. So what you need is here down at the bottom, you need that the parallel K vector in the silicon dioxide metal interface is equal to the square root of epsilon sub d times omega over c times the sine of the angle. That's what you're going to have for your parallel wave vector, and when those match properly, then you're going to get strong coupling to the surface plasmon mode. And again, I just want to point out that the surface plasmon mode at the metal prism interface was not going to be excited. We're looking at the mode at the metal air interface on the other side. And that's useful because that's outside of our system. If we had a surface plasmon, let's just say we did, at the metal dielectric interface, at the metal prism interface, well, it's all well and good, but it doesn't do us any good because it's buried in the system. I mentioned the auto configuration earlier.
That's sort of what happens in the auto configuration. You end up with a surface plasmon, but it's buried in the system and you can't really do anything with it. In this system, we can actually image, if you will, the surface plasmon mode. We can do things with it because it's external. It's on the outside edge of the system. And that's why this particular arrangement, this Kretschmann geometry, has been used so frequently. Yes?
When you use the planes to couple life to the metal, there's a distance between the metal and the planes. So you just couple life to from the planes to air, and then there's still to how to say there's still you means that you get.
You still get total internal reflection in that case. That could be the case. Well, like I said, we'll look at some graphs here, and if there's still some questions, then we can discuss it as we get to it, okay?
How thick are these metal films?
The metal films are quite thin. They're, in practice, they have to be around 20. I think you can go up to about 40 or 50 nanometers. But they're quite thin. And
what about compared to the skin depth for those metals?
Well, you can calculate the skin depth at the frequencies that we're looking at. It's going to be on the same order, in the tens, I would say in the tens of nanometers, if my recollection holds. But Schumann brought up an interesting point. There may be some air between the metal and the dielectric. I don't want to say that that's the case right off the top of my head. I don't recall, and we can discuss it as we get to that, or afterwards if you want. So here we have a quantitative description of the coupling of the surface plasmon polaritons. So what we're going to be doing is calculating for the reflection coefficient. And we're going to be using Maxwell's equations to solve for that. We're going to use Maxwell's equations to solve for the system that's shown here. We have incident light with E and H polarized as shown. We have three regions. The zero region is prism, the one region is metal, and the two region is air. So we have two dielectrics and one metal. We have a distance D of the metal, and then we're looking at the reflected light in a detector. That's the detector D. And we're looking for the case when there's no reflection. That will be the case when we have maximum coupling to the surface plasmon polariton. Of course, no reflection is sort of a dream case. There's always some imperfections in the system that you'll actually use. And so what you look for is the maximum dip in reflection in experimental results. But in theory, at least if we ignore a few of the things, we can look for maximum reflection or zero reflection, maximum transmittance or zero reflection. And Vlad has pointed out that you can use transfer matrix theory to find this case. I'm not going to go through this. It's not terribly terribly important for your future interest in this class. But if you're interested for later use, we've got the expression here on the page. The reflection coefficient looks something like as shown here. And the amplitude reflection coefficients are given by the expressions below that. Those are the Fresnel coefficients, which you can look up in an optics book if you prefer. And there are some notes here at the bottom, which I'll go through. The light intensity reflected back from the surface depends on this film thickness, this distance D, which is intuitively obvious. If you have a very, very thick film, then your light intensity reflected back out of the surface is going to be different. And there also exists a film thickness which gives the best coupling or perfect coupling, and that occurs when you have perfect destructive interference between the two reflected beams. And when the light is coupled in perfectly to your surface plasmon mode, all of the electromagnetic energy is going to be dissipated in the film.
So here are these graphs that I've been mentioning. If we take this system and we actually look at the output of the detector, or the reflectance, if you will, of the system, we can get a graph that'll look something like this. What you see here are dips in reflection. They correspond to different wavelengths of incident light. On the bottom, we have degrees of incident theta, the incident light angle. And on the left side, the vertical axis, we have reflectance. And you can see that, this is not in terms of wavelength, this is in terms of thickness of the film. And it's in angstroms, so CU2. To get to your question, the range here is 20 nanometers to almost 90 nanometers. Let's take with the D equals 20 or 200 angstroms, 20 nanometers line. So for a very thin film, you can see that there's a critical angle at which total internal reflection starts to occur. And this tends to sort of drop off slowly. It doesn't show on the graph here, but it's not very interesting. It doesn't do anything all that great for us. If we go to 370 angstroms, or 37 nanometers, then we start to see something very interesting. We again get a drop off at a little shy of 46 degrees, so our incident angle is about 46 degrees. And we see that the dip is quite strong. You go from almost perfect reflection at 45 degrees to well below half reflection at 46, or between 46 and 45. And then you come back up at about 48 degrees to about 80% reflection. So this is a very strong dip. It's pretty wide in terms of angle, but some of the other dips are even deeper and narrower. For example, the 490 angstrom thickness of the film shows a very nice dip. It's almost perfect reflection, perfect transmittance at the angle at which surface plasmon coupling occurs. So what's going on here is that at the point of the dip, the strongest dip in reflection, which translates to the highest transmittance into the surface plasmon mode, we're getting maximum coupling of the incident wave into our surface plasmon mode on the other side of the film. It depends on film thickness, as shown here. It depends on angle, also as shown here. And are there any questions specific to what we've got here on these graphs? This is very typical of what are called surface plasmon sensors, surface plasmon resonance sensors, which typically all use a Kretschmann geometry. We'll get into that here in a second. Kuping.
So there is a typical graph about the epsilon. So this means that in different thickness, the epsilon will change.
The two graphs for epsilon are epsilon sub r and epsilon sub i. I'll be honest with you, I haven't looked at this particular, at the original work in a couple of years, and my guess would be that those are the real and imaginary parts of the metal, and they do change with thickness. So yes. Yes?
What is the damping of the SPP? What is that?
You mean what is the mechanism by which it occurs?
Yeah.
We're going to get to that in just a second. That's a very good question. The question was about the damping of the surface plasmon mode. There is damping, as noted by the width of these dips. And the damping will come up here in just a moment. Up until now, we haven't talked about damping, and so you would expect a very sharp line with maximum transmittance at the surface plasmon point, surface plasmon coupling point. But, of course, that's not the case, and we have failed to take into consideration a few intricacies. So an intuitive way to look at this system is that it's a resonating system. And when the real part, the
magnitude of the real part of the metal dielectric function is much, much greater than 1, we're going to be well below the surface plasmon frequency. If we also have the imaginary part of the metal dielectric function magnitude much, much less than the real part of the metal dielectric function magnitude, which is a way of saying that the Q factor of the resonator is going to be high, then we have low loss. And if we have those two things, then our Lorentzian will look something like this. It's going to be, our reflection coefficient will look something like this. It's going to have a Lorentzian line shape, which is typical of resonating systems. And the width of the line shape is going to be given by damping, as was noted earlier. We have damping in this system due to resistive heating in the metal, for example. We also have damping due to re-radiation into the prism due to imperfect coupling of the metal prism interface, for example, or surface roughness at that interface, or all sorts of things that will give us a re-radiation at the prism metal interface. And if we look at the reflection coefficient, we can describe it in terms of a Lorentzian line shape by this formula. We have 4 times the damping terms over a typical Lorentzian denominator. The graph of this function is on the right, where we have perfect reflection until we reach a wave vector that's reasonably close to our resonant wave vector. Then we start to see a dip at the resonant wave vector. We see maximum dip in reflection, which again corresponds to maximum peak in transmission into the surface plasmon, if you want to think of it like that. And then our line shape recovers back to 1 as we move away from the resonant K vector. And you'll note that on the graph we have a dip that does not go to 0. If we had damping due to resistive heating equal damping due to radiative heating, radiative losses into the prism, then our resistance would go to 0, as noted at the bottom here. So let's look at some results of people using this geometry, this Kretschmann geometry. The Kretschmann geometry is sort of broadly termed as surface plasmon resonance. So we have here the surface plasmon resonance technique. There are other ways to do surface plasmon resonance, but by and large, almost all of them use this Kretschmann geometry in some form or another. This is an investigation of Langmuir, Blodgett, Kuhn films. If you're interested, you can look that up on your favorite search engine or in Web of Science. The point that I want to make with this slide is that, again, we have sort of a typical surface plasmon resonance graph. We have reflectance that's very high. It then dips at a particular incidence angle and then recovers as we go past that incidence angle. And so as the angle of incidence corresponding to maximum transmittance, or if you will, minimum reflectance, we get maximum coupling into the surface plasmon mode. And what these folks are doing is they're taking their Kretschmann geometry, and on top of that metal air interface, they're actually layering films, these LBK films. And what they find is that they can measure, using surface plasmon reflectance coupling, they can measure not quite individual layers of films, but very close, a few very thin films of this particular system, and that allows them to determine how thick their film is without damaging the film itself. So the coupling angle, the angle at which you get maximum coupling to the surface plasmon mode, is strongly dependent upon the thickness of the final LBK films. So if you have many layers, it's going to be a different angle than if you have a few layers. That makes sense because what you're doing is you're actually changing the dielectric function at the metal at the top interface of the Kretschmann geometry. It would have been air and metal. If we add some other films, then it's going to be dielectric of those films and the metal. And so the interface that the surface plasmon sees is going to change, which means that the wave vector will change and the coupling angle will change. And they note here that you can detect just a few layers in this system, and it's very, very useful if you wanted to, for example, you could think of perhaps doing, if you wanted, doing epitaxy systems where your measurement of layers would be based on a surface plasmon system. It's not quite as great as what they use now, but it's feasible at least. This is the system that's more often used. This is a biosensor system. There are companies that are in business selling systems for biodetection based on Kretschmann geometries, and they one of them that I know off the top of my head is a place called Biocore, and I would imagine that if they don't have a picture very similar to this, then they have one only slightly different. So let me tell you what's going on here. We have our prism is now upside down from what we've seen it before, but we still have our prism. We have polarized light coming in, focused through the prism to a point in our Kretschmann geometry where we have a gold film. And then we look at the reflected light and we look at the angles of the reflected light. So it's similar to what we're looking at before, except this time now they have a flow channel on the far side of the metal. And they've attached these little red antibodies to this in this flow channel, and the antibodies are targeted towards particular antigens, and so then they flow through the fluid attached to the far side of this channel. They flow a fluid of stuff which may or may not have these antigens in it. If it does have the antigens, the antibodies and the antigens will bind, and you get a local change in the dielectric function at the metal interface on the far side where your surface plasmons are excited. So the surface plasmons then experience a different dielectric, which means that they have a different incidence angle that will couple most strongly. And you can actually detect this by the shift in the incidence angle that you see. And you can tailor this. You can use, instead of antibodies and antigens, you can use, as mentioned here, some thiol chemistry to tag these antigens to the gold, for example, or tag anything you want to the gold. So that thing will stay there, and then you flow past it something that it will bind to. And the binding event is what you're detecting, and you're detecting it by a shift of your resonance frequency, a shift of your resonance angle in the sensor. Can anybody think of any disadvantages? There are several advantages listed here. I believe that I've mentioned most of them. The evanescent field interacts with the adsorbed molecules only. Why does that happen? It's because the evanescent field has a very short length scale. And so if these molecules that flow past don't get bound, then they're never really close enough to affect the dielectric function of the closest layers to the gold, which is where your surface plasmon will be found. It's an evanescent mode surface plasmon, so it's going to be very close to the gold interface anyhow. It's a guided mode. There's a couple of other advantages. There are a few disadvantages of this system. Can anybody think of anything off the top of their head what a disadvantage of this might be? Yes, Justin.
If it's hard to get the antibodies and the antigens to dissociate, it would only be
a... That's a good point. It might be a one-shot use. If you can't get these things to unbind, or you can't clean them off and start over, that's a good point. Another disadvantage is, what if you get Let's say you're going to build this sensor and you're going to build it for anthrax. So you tag the goal with some anthrax antibodies or antigens, whichever. You can tag it with either and then look for the opposite one. And you find that the antibody-antigen pair is not quite as preferentially binding as you'd hoped. And so you get anthrax that binds, but you also get variations of other spores that bind. So now you also get a shift in your resonance angle, but you don't know for sure if it's anthrax or something else that has bound to the system. So the detection is very high. You can detect very easily if something has bound. The downside is you have to play with the chemistry, and you have to know the chemistry very, very well to be able to say with surety that it is what you wanted that bound, because all you're looking for is a dielectric function shift. So that's a downside with this particular technique. That doesn't mean that it's not useful. It's being used for things like homeland security, biosensors, things like that. There are companies out there that are using this technique in the field to look for all sorts of things. One of the ways that they do this is they can actually multiplex. I'll take a big gold piece with many prisms or one large prism, and you can look for lots of things all at once. You can also image these surface plasma polariton waves. I'm not going to go through this too terribly much, but again, we have our Kretschmann geometry. Again, we have our surface plasmon coupling system. You can kind of ignore for a moment all of the optics here at the bottom of the page, but just think of it as the same system as we had before, except that this time we have a near-field optical microscope, scanning optical microscope, which is, if you're not familiar with it, it's a, think of it as an AFM with a fiber tip. So the AFM in tapping mode will have a tip that taps into and out of the spaces in between whatever you're looking at on your film, and you can image the surface. If you replace that, typically a silicon or metal tip, with a fiber tip, then you can actually put light in or extract light out in the nanoscale using an optical tip. That's what we're looking at here. And so what's going on is we have a tip that's moving in and out, taps into the near field of the surface plasmon polariton. Some of the light from the surface plasmon polariton, remember, it's just an evanescent mode, so it's only close to the metal. Some of the light gets coupled to the fiber, and that light is then detected by the photomultiplier tube in our ENSOM setup, which means that we can actually image these surface plasmon modes in a two-dimensional scenario. And that's what some folks have done. They're looking at the attenuation of the surface plasmon polaritons. One of the things that I didn't mention yet is that these things tend to attenuate rather quickly. They are excited at the point of interface of your excitation of the incident field, your incident light, for example, and then they propagate along the interface of the metal-air interface. The length of propagation is what these folks are looking at here, and they find that they can actually image this with this ENSOM scenario that I just mentioned, and they're looking at a decay length on the order of microns. Now, if you think about that, that is, it's short in terms of, you know, in terms of what you think of how far light would go, typically. These are evanescent modes, and they're traveling many wavelengths, if you want to think of it that way, many wavelengths before dying out. So they're actually propagating quite far. There are references at the bottom of most of these pages for the experimental results, if you're interested. If you try to find them and you have trouble, let me know. I was able to find all of them, but I had to do a little bit of digging.
There are other ways to excite the surface plasma on polariton. One of the ways is with the grating structure. In this way, you can actually match the wave vectors, which is really the key, is to match the wave vectors. I won't go through the gory details of this, but the upshot is, under certain conditions, if you have your grating produced properly, then you can match the wave vector of your incident light directly to surface plasmons along the grating. And there's a strong coupling point where your parallel K vector in the silicon dioxide and the surface plasmon K vector plus some grating parameters, plus or minus some grating parameters because it's periodic, will match.
So this periodicity gives you, I guess, as in regular semiconductor, the periodicity, the lattice would give you momentum vectors corresponding to that periodicity.
Right. It's the periodicity, yeah, exactly. The periodicity is giving you the ability to match those momentum vectors.
Yeah. So that's what I guess happens here too. The periodicity gives you extra these G's, capital G's.
Right.
But one thing we know is if you put a delta function, it will give you all the momenta you need. In other words, if you put a defect, instead of this periodic structure, would that allow you to satisfy momentum requirements?
Yeah, there are some systems that do couple to surface plasmon modes due to defects in a periodic structure. We're going to get to those in just a minute. You can also look at excitation of a surface plasmon polariton with a single dot. You can sort of think of this, if you want, as a defect in a perfect film, if you prefer. I'm not going to go through this in great detail either. However, we do have a strong coupling relationship. It looks somewhat similar to our grating relationship, except that our plus minus contribution is from the dot instead of from the grating. I will say that this particular experimental results, which was in Applied Physics Letters in 2002, the experimental results are done using a fluorescence technique. So what's going on there? What we see is a dipolar radiation pattern from the dot. The dot is a metal. It's sitting on a field of a fluorescing dye, R6G, which happens to be a laser dye at red. Some of the red frequencies, there's different ones. And so they excite the surface plasmon polariton in the metal dot, and then the plasmon propagates, and you can image the fluorescence as a result of the interaction of the plasmon with the dye. So the plasmon produces fluorescence in the dye then fluoresces, and you can image that. So that's what's going on here. They're imaging the fluorescence from the dye itself, and we get this dipolar pattern, which if you remember from Hertzian antennas, for example, have a pattern that's very similar. This can be thought of as a sort of a simple, simplified down to a Hertzian antenna. The dipole radiation pattern is shown in a cartoon form here in the bottom. So the point of this is to show that you can get surface plasmon polaritons that resonate. That are excited through different structures. Here are other excitation geometries. One of them is we'll call it a microstrip, 200 nanometers in width, 60 nanometers high. So it's sort of a truncated version of our pretty film on our prism. We again get something that looks sort of dipolar. Of course, there's some damping from the fact that we have a semi-infinite strip, or at least infinite in terms of the length of the surface plasmon polariton. And then if we have two dots, we get a nice, interesting multipolar pattern as well. And so this work is done also, it's from the same paper, also this is done with a fluorescence imaging technique. Um, Here's another way of exciting surface plasma on polaritons. This is somewhat similar to the previous method. What we're doing here is we're looking at a defect, if you will, or some difference in a film, and exciting scattering light at that point, which produces a surface plasma on polariton excitation along the film. This is a little bit similar to what we've gone through before. So unless there are specific questions, I won't go through this in any detail. Okay. And then we have this technique, which is shown schematically here at the top. We have a sort of a launch pad, if you will, for surface plasma on polaritons. We're using a prism coupling system. However, instead of a flat metal film that goes all the way across, they've actually raised part of the metal film, and they've narrowed that part also. So what's going on here is we have our metal film or a metal stripe, which would, in general, allow us to excite a surface plasma on polariton, and then they've narrowed it down and raised it away from the surface. And you would expect that if you were over here, you wouldn't get surface plasma coupling, just generally. But you can launch it from here into this small stripe, and that's what they've gone and shown. The upper picture here is a atomic force microscope image of the metal launch pad, and then we have a near-field microscope image. These were taken at the same time. Of the oscillations along this launch pad, and you can see that you do get peaks in the surface plasmon excitation along the metal stripe, and the peaks are from the oscillations, if you will, are from the various reflections that are hitting the end and coming back. And here's what that looks like with a graph of any intensity. And again, the back reflections are the cause of the oscillations in that intensity profile along the stripe. And this is what was mentioned earlier with a periodic structure. If we have a periodic structure, we can actually produce band gaps in our system, full band gaps. And so you would say that you can't excite a surface plasmon because you have these gaps and you can't get in there. But then if we look at a periodic structure, a photonic crystal structure where you have defects, then you can actually guide these surface plasmons. So that's what's going on here. These are photonic crystals, and they have experimentally created these for the purpose of guiding surface plasmons along an interface. In the periodic portion, the gap exists, and so you can't have excitation of the surface plasmon. In the non-periodic portion, you have surface plasmon excitation as you would expect, and those are guided by the fact that they can't propagate into the periodic structure. This is if Dr. Shalayev hasn't discussed this in a little bit of schematic, he will. I don't know. I can't remember if it's before or after this lecture. But this is pretty exciting stuff. If you could, for example, if you could build these into a chip, then you could guide surface plasmon modes as your chip signaling system. Yes?
This is the last picture. It seems like the DOS has some empty hole in it. That's, let's say, it has to be like a ring structure on the surface.
You're talking about the Y splitter and the fact that they look like small donuts?
Yeah.
My guess is that that's a feature of the imaging of this picture. I doubt that they're actually donut shaped. They may be. I'm not familiar enough with this work as to how they made those dots. And if they were, in fact, ring shaped as you or have a ring cross section, then
you would still, it's still a periodic structure. You would still be able to expect a band gap. It may be shifted based on the amount of metal versus dielectric that's in that periodic structure, or it may be that those particular, if they exist, those particular dielectric pieces are much, much smaller than the system size, and then no, wouldn't really affect performance other than, for example, in terms of loss. But my first guess is that that's a artifact of the imaging. Here are some of the results using these structures. The parameters of the spacing of the dots and the SPP excitation wavelengths are given. We have an AFM microscope image here on the left and then a near-field microscope image on the right. And you can see that in that first open space, you do get quite a lot of coupling. The surface plasmon propagates quite nicely down that stripe of defects. So that pretty much covers today's lecture. We've gone through a few things, and I just want to go over them again. The most important one, as far as what I'm going to tell you, is probably the most important one today, is this concept of the Kretschmann geometry and how you can use it to excite surface plasmon modes at a metal dielectric interface. But remember, it's not at the prism dielectric interface, prism metal interface. It's on the other side. You can use those for sensors. For example, we looked at a few cases of that. There are also other ways of exciting these plasmon modes. One of them is a grating coupling, where the periodicity allows you to match the wave vectors quite nicely. And then you can use coupling schemes such as a metal dot or a series of metal dots or things like that. And then we can guide these surface plasmon polaritons using schemes such as stripes and wires. They will be guided along the metal interface, so it's somewhat similar to your standard waveguide thinking, a little bit different sometimes, but they do waveguiding in what could be considered a sort of a standard waveguiding mode. They just have They have to play tricks with building these things because they're not typical sizes. We can use line defects in periodic hexagonal arrays, which are two-dimensional photonic crystals. Those are quite interesting results. And then next lecture, again, you don't have any class Tuesday nor any class Thursday. Next lecture will be next Tuesday, not the coming one, but the one after. And that will be on nanoparticle arrays. Are there any questions from what we covered today? I hope that I've given you a pretty good overview of what's going on. We have one question to you.
Have you guys thought of how to convert this surface plasmon to electrical signal?
How to convert it directly?
I mean, after, so at this point we have surface plasmon originating from the laser light. Can we turn it into an electrical signal?
You could use a photodetector, in fact, if you really wanted to.
No, we are not doing photodetectors. Can you go from there to an electrical signal in the substrate itself? Because I thought that's what we were after to begin with.
What we're after is coupling the surface plasmon with light. Strictly.
In the scheme of things at the very beginning, you know, we wanted to bring light into the nano transistor regime.
Right.
So I was wondering whether you guys have thought of that interface.
Well, what I'm saying is that it doesn't make much sense to think about it in terms of electrical signals. What you really want is a light signal at the end of the day. So this is a way of taking light in, which has a wavelength of hundreds of nanometers, and you're guiding it in a system that has a cross-section of, let's say, a third of that, or half of that, or even less, for example. And this is not something that you can do in for example, the microwave regime. where all of your resonators and all of your waveguides have to be the size of, you know, the size of what you're looking at, the size of the wavelength, or a couple of wavelengths perhaps. So we're looking at guiding these light signals, these modes that have wavelengths on the order of 300 or 400 or 500 nanometers with a strip that has a size dimension of a third of that, you know, maybe 100 nanometers or 200 nanometers. And then on the other side, coupling it back out to the light, which is again 500 nanometers or 600 nanometers, or if it's, you know, out in the long visible, it's, you know, 700 nanometers wavelength. So the whole goal is to couple light in and out of these nanoscale devices. How you might couple the surface plasmons to an electrical signal is not something that we've talked about, and it's a little bit outside of the realm of this class. It's interesting. I just don't know off the top of my head. You'd use it, for example, for interconnects on a chip, perhaps, right?
These would be pretty bad interconnects because you saw how fast it decays, the surface plasmon.
How long is your chip?
I mean, it's centimeter by centimeter.
Now?
Chip.
I mean, now your chip is centimeter by centimeter, but...
But your signal decays in like 10 micrometers.
I'm saying, what if your chip is a micron by a micron? And everything is done like this, then you're okay. Okay, any other questions? All right, thanks, guys.